Second, Reverend, you can take out the delayed signs there, too. It's 2:08 p.m. on the 19th of March, 2012, and members present, Representative Guerra, Representative Jewell, Representative Wilson, Representative Eric Lostholtz, Co-Chair Thomas, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgman, and Representative Costello. We have a quorum to do business. We have two items on the schedule, House Bill 258 and House Bill 337. We had a previously heard bill, which we have a the Snow Classic. It has we've come up with a proposed CS. There were some thoughts about trying to see if we could do some things for the dog mushing community. And frankly, gaming and its national implications and things you do on the Internet are a lot more complicated than we realized, and way beyond the scope of time of this co-chair and probably our ability to work through this committee. So we the CS we have before us just adds in addition to the Snow Classic, which is the body of the bill, it adds the that internet is advertising is included in the broadcasting. That was that's really the crux of it. And I'll invite Mr. Michelle up to discuss this after we if we can have a motion to move the finance CS. And Ms. Lucky is here for Representative Hawker's office online. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill 245, Finance 27-LS0862/E11319-12 before the committee.
Is there any objection? Hearing none. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Joe Michelle, staff to House Finance. The bill before you today in the CS, the first three sections are exactly the same. Section 4 is what I'd like to draw your attention to. And there's a lot of...
The same as previously presented by the sponsor, the body of the original bill.
It's the same as brought forward by the sponsor of the bill. You can see that under A2, the words internet or an internet communication to promote a charitable gain and activity under this chapter. There is a lot of questions on whether internet, you know, because this does not allow additional people to, you know, broadcast over the airwaves such as TV or radio. All it does is acknowledge that the internet, people, charitable organizations will be able to post the time, the location of
the nature of their games.
Yeah. Yes. Judy Sherman, yes, sir.
Representative Costello.
Through the chair, just a quick question. So it doesn't allow then people to actually purchase the tickets through the internet, just simply to learn about it. Is that my understanding?
Through the chairman, Representative Costello. No, it does not. There's many, many rules on the federal level in regards to interstate commerce. And I mean, I could cite examples of poker down in the Cayman Islands and things of that nature. And open up that.
It'd be international commerce.
International commerce. No, it does not.
And this is, we've worked on this in concurrence with the sponsor of the bill. It's an expansion of the bill that passed a couple years ago on allowing the broadcast advertising of games. And this allows to take, I guess, as we talked the other day, everybody has an internet. Not everybody reads the paper anymore, at least in the public paid prescriptions. Subscriptions, excuse me. They're not a prescription. They're not curing anything. I believe all Ms. Lucky, are you online to comment on the legislation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm online. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Julie.
Okay, for the record, this is Julie Lucky from Representative Mike Hawker's office, and the sponsor's office has reviewed the CS, and we have no objection to the language in the CS.
Any other questions from the committee? We don't have an updated fiscal note, but I don't believe this will have any fiscal impact. That's been my... We didn't have one, Rich. So are there any amendments? Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, it's not an amendment to the bill, but it's a correction for the record. If you recall, last time this bill was before us, I was asking the Department of Revenue in gaming whether there was a limit on raffle tickets sales, and they indicated that there wasn't, or if there was, it was $100. And I said I thought, oh, it was much lower, 20. Well, it's lower than that. It's 10. And I'm confirming with my staff, and she's nodding her head yes, that the state of Alaska has limited raffle ticket sales at $10. And I say this for two reasons, Mr. Chairman. One, I think that number is way too low, and so I've asked why we're limiting raffles to $10. But two, just so that other nonprofits that might be out there listening will recognize and know that if they don't want to be in violation of the law, their raffle ticket shouldn't be higher than $10. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm confused by that correction because I can't count how many raffle tickets I've bought well in excess of $10. Maybe this might save me some money if there was a clarification, including recently $100 raffle tickets. And raffle and lotteries are used interchangeably. A lottery is essentially a raffle, as it's been explained to me, both folks from. So
Mr. Chairman, for the better.
I would like somebody on the record, because I hate to, as I, Mr. Prather, do you? I would like some clarification on this. There's certainly what may be declared as what the regulations of the statute is, but I know the common practice, so I'd sure invite you up here. And maybe we can put on the record the different types of raffles, maybe, or that might be the difference. A lot of people listen to this these proceedings, I found out, far more than I would ever have dreamed. And hi, Mom. Mr. Prather.
Jeff Prather, the supervisor of the gaming section and the tax division of the Department of Revenue.
Can you shed any light on this elusive number, that limit or non-limit? But
Last week, Representative Faircloth asked about if there was a limit on the sale of on the price of a ticket, a raffle ticket, and I told her no, there was not. I subsequently, after testifying here, I realized that I'd made a mistake and informed her staff that there is a limit on special draw raffles, and the limit is $10 a ticket. There is no limit on any other raffle tickets.
And what is a special draw raffle? I think that's what the confusion is.
A special draw raffle is a raffle where the winner is determined by means other than drawing from a container. A typical example of a special draw raffle is a rubber ducky race.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. Just for clarification purposes, I have read and have tested, so I'm probably putting my own test on the line here. But if it's just drawing it out of a bucket, then it's not being interpreted correctly still, because I go to multiple events where people pull a out of a bag or a drawing. So as an example, one of the games that I've seen played at various events are a raffle where they sell a card out of a deck of cards, which has a limited number of raffles, and per the department, they can only sell those for $10. And that's being included under a special issue permit. But they're drawing, there's a limited number of cards, and it's usually drawn at an event. There's also balloon sales, ring sales, where you'll purchase something and the last person standing. Are there limits on those too?
Well, those, if they're permitted under a special draw permit, then it's $10. If the activity is permitted under a special draw, if they have a special drop permit to conduct that activity, then the limit is $10.
I'd say there probably needs to be a better education process amongst all the people conducting these, because I've been paying twice as much as I should have, and it would lighten my load. But I think I don't think it's anything that's done with malice. I think it's just probably just needs to be better communication, and that goes on their responsibility side too, and becoming more aware.
Mr. Chairman, the reason that I've brought it up for at least 4, if not 6 years with the department itself is because I'm not sure why the amount was set at $10. I've asked that question repeatedly. I've never gotten an answer. As someone who tries to help charities raise money, a $20 bill is easy to take out of your pocket as a 10 when people are attending events, and so I'm not sure why the department is limiting it at that price. I just ask the question, and I continue to wait for that answer. But in fairness, I've only asked this gentleman once, and he's going to try to get me the answer in the next couple days.
And I probably won't pursue anymore because there's probably some people doing some good here inappropriately, and I don't want to.
The
less we know. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move from the committee the CS for House Bill 245, Finance 27-LS-0862/E, attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, that bill is moved out of committee. We'll stand briefly and at ease waiting for the asbestos bill. Still the 19th of March. We have before us House Bill 258. We have a committee substitute, which working with the sponsor and the departments, that made a number of technical changes. I would move that, have that moved.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill 258, Finance 27-LS-0400/S, Nauman 31612.
It's a little more complicated. I'm going to object so people can hear what's in it. It's not as simple as it. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, coordination with Mr. Anderson.
For the record, my name is Joe Michelle, House Finance Staff. The CS before you, version S, there are 14 changes to it. What went on was, since the bill left House Transportation, the Department of Law, DOT, and Department of Health and Social Services had to do a lot of coordination in what they were actually going to do as far as writing regs and things of that nature. And after Department of Law, HESS, and DOT got talked, these are the reflective changes they felt that needed to be made. In your packets, there is the list of changes that are available, and that's what I'll just be going through. On the start on page 3, lines 14 through 16, this was something Roth felt should be put into protect agencies and officers, employees of the states for against certain liability. On the same page 3, section D, that was inserted, and that was a Department of Law and Department of Hess working together. On page 4.
Yeah, please continue to give the ownership of each recommended change.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On page 4, on line 8, this cites a statute, actionable claims against the state, and that's the law inserted, suggested that. Also at the bottom of section A, on line 13, you'll see this wording in a few more of these changes, and it's agencies, officers, and employees. All right. On page 5, on line 4, you'll see the same language, or officer or employee of the state. On page 5, line 16 and line 21, this is the Department of Law separating the state from an actual contractor who's doing that before they were together, and that was separated out. That was a law decision. Moving on to page 6, line 12 and 13.
We make decisions, they make recommendations.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I don't want them to get a little too cocky.
On page 6, line 12 and 13, it says, coordinate with the Department of Natural Resources to establish and maintain a database. This was put in for the purpose that a Department of Natural Resources already has a large database, and for when they're graphing out where asbestos is, DNR would be an excellent person to consult. On page 9, line 29, this was a Department of Law suggestion. The word approved was entered in on line 29, and it was hoped that would better specify what was required from the department. On page 10, line 9, the word may was included, and it specifically allows the option for DOT to send copies of certain materials instead of requiring DOT to send the specific material. The reason being, when you list certain materials that need to be sent out, if that's not updated material, then, you know, the department would be sending out bad material. So it gives them the option to say, well, you don't want this to begin with, is what that is for. On page 10, line 31, and continuing on to page 11, down to line 7, This was working out with DOT to provide DOT the required regulatory authority to provide under the Administrative Procedure Act to write the necessary regulations for this bill to happen. On page 11, line 25, the purpose of this was required DOT, it works in tandem with the change just at the top of the page, to establish regulations that include specific components of the site-specific plan. And finally, on page 12, line 28, due to the fact that there are so many regulations that need to be worked out, the Department of Transportation feels that another year it would accomplish. They would be able to write the regulations a little bit better if they were given an extra year. That is the final change to the House Finance CS. HB 258.
You have anything to add, Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, my name is Bernie Anderson. I work for Representative Reggie Jules as legislative aide. Mr. Michelle did an excellent job of describing the changes that we've had to work through since transportation.
Did you say adequate?
Yes.
I got to work with the guy.
Good to go.
Okay. Any other questions from committee members? I'll remove my objection. Are there other objections? Any other objections to adopting this CS as presented? Hearing none, it's before us. Representative Jewell?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee, this has turned out to be an adventure with a simple goal. For a number of years now, in one of the more resource-rich parts of the state lies a few communities, two of which are having trouble with their capital projects moving forward because they are so mineral-rich, and that's with the naturally occurring asbestos that is in association with those communities. And some of the capital projects that have been in hold over the years include things like airport extensions, replacements of bridges, being able to deal with their water and sewer, or even just building homes. And this has been an issue now for going on 10 years. And at different points in times, we've had some starts and stops. But at the end of the day, legislation is needed to get a lot of these projects off the dime. And we've gone down those roads previously, started them, and worked with some of the departments. And here we are today after several failed attempts to get things going and a period of time where Mr. Chairman, that we've ended up working in, as you can tell, with the departments in detail because of how this is impacted. And in part, this is an issue because this is on privately owned land. And so with that, I think is kind of the overview. You know, we have a roads to resources that's eventually going to get to the Upper Kobuk Mineral District at some point. And normally under situations, whether it's here in Juneau or other places in Alaska, when you run into naturally occurring asbestos, the thing that you do is you cap it. You use some of the resource, and then you put asphalt or pavement on top. And that comes at a much more considerable expense when you're dealing with things out in rural areas. But at some point, and I think today, we just need to deal with this and so that those communities can have the benefit of seeing some of the economic development and the growth in the communities that their communities need, and they're kind of hamstrung right now without something there to allow them to do this. So with that, I think that Brody can answer all of the more detailed questions since he's worked this thing ad nauseum.
Sure. Well, we have, and I'd just like to note, we have a whole cast of characters here that are available for questions. We have Gray Mitchell from the Department of Labor. We have Alice Edwards from DEC Air Quality. She's a director. We have Roger Healy, chief engineer from DOT. We have Christina Markowitz from Department of Labor in Anchorage online. We have Sarita Angelville from the Department of Law in Anchorage. We have Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal, here in the audience, or online, one of the other. And we have Dr. Paul Anderson from Anchorage, from the Department of Health and Social Services, all have signed up. So if you have questions relevant to them, those folks are all available. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, my first question is understanding the health issues surrounding the use of naturally occurring asbestos and how it's encapsulated in something so that it's not moving into, so it's not airborne, or how that all works from a health perspective.
That could go either to DEC or to HESS. Do you have a preference, Representative Jewell? Why don't we let, why don't you take a shot, Mr. Anderson, and we'll see if DEC or Hess want to endorse your answer.
Thank you, Chairman. I think the best answer for the health concerns or the health issues related to asbestos and naturally occurring gravel would be the Department of Hess, and so Mr. Anderson. Probably we've worked extensively with, there's two sections of the bill. There's the analytical threshold of establishing gravel naturally occurring asbestos at 0.25, which came from the department, from actually California. California has a viable operating program that's been in effect since, I believe, 1996. So we took a lot of our examples from them and then worked with the Hess department to work with that threshold, and then also the intent language in Section D. The last portion of that in regards to the public health exposure was written by the department, so I think they would best be able to describe.
Okay, we'll go to Dr. Anderson. Did you have any elaboration on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Bearclaw, the
Bearclaw.
I'm sorry, sir.
Bearclough, not Bearclaw. No donuts today.
There's no health threat if naturally occurring asbestos remains undisturbed and does not become airborne. However, natural weathering and human disturbance can break down naturally occurring asbestos to the microscopic fibers that can readily become suspended in the air and become damaging if inhaled. So that's the focused answer to the question.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up, so we have gravel that is going to be extracted. At least that's what's being proposed, and it's going to be moved, so we're going to have particulate matter in the air. So I'm wondering how we protect workers and how that works when it's going to be airborne. There's going to be dust, or is there ways to mitigate the dust with water, or, and could you tell me the grade of the asbestos that we're looking at? I understand there's different qualities and grades of asbestos, so there are some that are more harmful than others.
Yes, through the chair, there are two different classes of asbestos fibers. There are serpentine asbestos fibers. They are generally curly fibers. And the common name for them is chrysotile, and it's basically a snake-like asbestos mineral when you look at it under a microscope. And the other class is known as amphiboly or amphibole asbestos fibers, and they're straight and needle-like. And there's six different kinds. I can reel through them: amosite, crocodilite, tremolite, actinolite, and anthrophyllite. And in the ambler area, the fibers are chrysotile. So that would be in the first group, in the serpentine group. So that's what we have in the ambler area. And so basically, as you know, asbestos occurs naturally in the environment throughout the world, and it's most commonly found in ultramafic and mafic rocks, so not only in the ambler area but other places around the state. And so when we look at asbestos fibers, we are trying to basically establish the fact that for human health, there is no acceptable exposure that we have, although we do take measures to minimize it. So we basically don't allow exposures at all. So what we have tried to establish is that people would not be exposed to airborne dust. And when that situation cannot be avoided, there are threshold limits that have been established for workers.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. This bill doesn't distinguish between serpentine or other asbestos materials. Is that correct?
That's correct. And all fibers, all the different types of asbestos are considered to be harmful, although there is some suspicion that crocodilite fibers are actually the most harmful. But all asbestos fibers are considered harmful.
running, Doctor, if I might, running on that statement, then if all asbestos fibers are harmful, then is there mitigation that is available to make this extraction safe for workers and the community that might be neighboring this particular extraction or not?
Well, as I've mentioned, there's very robust regulations for the exposure of workers. And what we're talking about here is the use of asbestos-containing material for road surfaces and what happens once it's been used in the road surface and potentially becomes aerosolized. And so the approach that's, I believe, being established in the bill is that there is an analytical threshold. This is a test that you would use to take a sample and look at it for fibers of naturally occurring asbestos. And if that particular soil sample was examined under a microscope and the examiner did not see any fibers at all, the best that they can say is that they cannot say because they have only taken a certain number of views of the sample, but the best they can say is that asbestos content is less than 0.25% by weight, and that is the best. That's an analytical threshold, and so that is the best test we have. And what we're trying to establish is that if that test is performed and no asbestos is found, then we cannot say there is none there, but there is a very small amount, and it's below this analytical threshold that we have. If there is a higher amount of asbestos, that is, if asbestos is found, it must be used according to mitigation plans that have been laid out, and that is what has just been described this morning in terms of either burying or sealing the material so that it cannot be exposed, so people cannot be exposed to it. So there are very well-established mitigation approaches, as Representative Jewell mentioned. Some of them quite expensive, but they are very well described.
Mr. Chairman, I will let others go, but just to the sponsor or to Mr. Anderson, this bill deals with a content equal or greater to the 0.25% naturally occurring asbestos mass, allowing the use of the greater than, not the lesser than. I mean, you can already use the lesser than. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct. The components of the site-specific plan and the mitigation and monitoring plan begin at the point of the desire to use the gravel that actually has 0.25 or greater.
Mr. Chairman, I'll yield. I have some health concerns.
Okay. Does DEC have any follow-up comments on this, the other health component? I'm seeing negative nodding, for the record. It's not for the record if you're out there, but I'm just acknowledging. If you want to be on the record, you can come and sit up here. I will acknowledge that the two DEC officials nodded in the negative, sideways. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jewell, I would like to find a way to make this bill work, but I share the health concerns right now, so I think there may be ways to make the bill work, at least in a manner that I would consider safer. But for starters, is workers' comp available at least to those workers who get mesothelioma or asbestosis or lung cancer as a result of this?
Through the chair, Representative. That question was brought up just recently and by yourself and us speaking with you about it, and I have contacted Department of Law to actually get that question answered directly from the current language.
Okay.
Garrett.
That's one of the concerns I have, and that would partially protect the workers, though that won't protect the people who live in the area. Another concern I have is, just to lay this on the table so just everybody knows what asbestosis and mesothelioma are, can we have the doctor who was online just explain what it is so I shouldn't assume that everybody knows what it is.
Dr. Anderson, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. Representative, through the chair, asbestos exposure is most commonly associated with a type of lung cancer known as mesothelioma. It is a cancer that occurs in the lining of the lungs. And so there are a couple of non-malignant or non-cancerous lung conditions, and the most commonly known one is asbestosis, which is a chronic condition that basically causes a fibrosis or a hardening of the lungs. You get scar tissue in the lungs from prolonged exposure to asbestos, and this can be a progressive disease once the exposure has stopped. So those are the two most commonly known associated diseases that come from asbestos exposure.
Sure. And through the chair, doctors, am I correct with mesothelioma? One of the difficulties of treating it is that it's often not noticed until it's too far gone to treat.
Representative, through the chair, I think the best thing to say in this particular case is that the latency period for exposure to asbestos between the time you get exposed and the time the disease actually occurs is very long, which makes this a very difficult disease to study. And so oftentimes your statement is correct. There is a lot of development of disease before the person is actually diagnosed.
Through the chair. And I'm happy to yield, too, when you think it should go to somebody else.
I think we're in a good line of questioning here. Let's I've got two good rounds here, and we'll go to Representative Edgerman afterwards. So.
I guess from what I heard, and I just want to make sure I understand the bill correctly, so whoever knows the answer, we're not regulating it if it's below 0.25% by weight, you get immunity, but these site-specific plans don't apply. But if it's above 0.25% in weight, these site-specific plans are required. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative, that is correct. The immunity also doesn't kick in until the 0.25 level.
Now, is Mr. Anderson, not Dr. Anderson. It's for folks following, none of them are
So the immunity is connected also to the 0.25.
And then through the chair, but did I not hear from the Department of Health that there really is no established acceptable exposure level, that 0.25 isn't magically the safe point? Can you just let me know? I don't know how to ask that question better.
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, if I could ask, in your packets is included a 2005 report done by Department of HESS on the long-term low-level exposure to the Ambler. Ambler has had naturally occurring asbestos for quite a while. I mean, hundreds of years, and so the town was built. There's been previous testimony in the previous committee where there's levels at the riverbank that has asbestos as low as 0.2 to other portions of the town that has actually even higher into the full percentages. And so in 2005, Department HESS did a report on asbestos exposure, and that was included. And if I could get Dr. Anderson to maybe give a brief synopsis of what they found in that report.
Dr. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So I believe I have there's a very long history of investigations, of course, with regard to Ambler and public health. But I think the point of the gentleman's comments are that we have not found any malignant mesothelioma cases in that area. The ones that we have found in Alaska, all of them are probably attributed to occupational exposure. And I'm happy to be more specific or go more into the details of the history of our investigations there if the chairman would like.
Representative Kira.
Doctor, did you not say before that there was no acceptable level of exposure that is
for
known?
For health, yes.
Okay. And I understand the predicament that folks are facing in Ambler and maybe some of the other communities. I guess I have a concern that once we allow the use of asbestos, they'll start using it in places, naturally occurring asbestos, they might start using it in places where they don't have to. And Representative Jewell, let me ask you this. What if we required signage that said you're about to enter into an area where asbestos is being used that maybe may cause danger? I don't know how to write the signage. In an area like Amberley, I would go to their government and they would say, look, it's all we have. But if it were used in another area where they had some other option, the public would be able to bear holy heck on their government representative saying, why are you doing this? And that might at least prevent the spread of the use of naturally occurring asbestos where you don't need to use it. Would you have any problem with some sort of signage requirement, at least warning residents, neighbors?
Oh, I don't think that signage would be a problem, quite frankly. But I don't know if there are residents in Adler who aren't acutely aware of it because the fact of nothing getting done in their community for even building homes. Everybody knows what the holdup is, but I think you raise a good point that, as long as this doesn't, as long as, I guess, to maintain people's awareness, I think the community has met over these. It's because of the community that we have this legislation, I just want to make a point clear. I don't think I would be wanting to forward legislation that would put people's health at risk, and I want to make that clear. And at the same time, it's the members of the community and the growth of that community and just the sustainability of that community where asbestos in its naturally occurring state is curtailing projects from being done. Having said that, there has been an extensive search for clean sites near and far to the area, and I think we're having luck on clean sites, but it's going to cost somebody a bundle of money to build roads to get that to happen, but there has been continued search for clean sources of gravel. It is a continuing issue.
Mr. Anderson has a follow-up on this.
Thank you, Chairman. After I met with the representative, I went back, and this has been an extensive process of working with the different departments that are involved and trying to give them the tools they need in order to write something so complex as this bill is suggesting. And so regulation authority has come up. And when I went back, when I've gone back and talked with the departments trying to give them what they need but also not hamstring them in writing regulations, public notification was an issue that came up along with some of the other issues that have come up with what should we directly spell out or what should this committee and the legislators spell out directly in statute versus what should be reserved for regulations. And there's been a lot of going back and forth between that. And so in regards to signage, that is something I was told that does happen extensively in regulations, whether it's just a regular construction site that would be required, also with requirements in the mitigation and monitoring plan as well, how to keep it wet when you're talking about stockpile gravel, keeping it wet every night or covered, or the use of respirators, all of those issues would be spelled out in the site-specific plan and then the mitigation and monitoring plan. And those would all be spelled out through also the regulation being written as well. So we've tried to keep this fine balance of what should be in statute versus regulation.
Thank you. I'll just toss out some more ideas and then let it go to somebody else. I suppose I don't want attorneys to necessarily get rich off something like this, so maybe one of the ways you could make these projects move forward would be to, if you follow a site-specific plan, don't allow punitive damages, don't allow class actions, lawsuits, but to not allow compensation in case somebody does get this disease so they can take care of themselves. That's, I could live without the punitive damages or class action lawsuits. I'm not so sure the no compensation part of it sits so well for me. And if it's really that safe as it is in Ambler, if it really is, there's never going to be a lawsuit. But if it's not, I have some concern. I would want the signage not just for workers, but for residents who are in the area where the dust might be. And then the only other question I have is, if it's below 0.25% in weight, there's no ceiling that's required, but if it's above 0.25% in weight, there is ceiling required? Is that how the bill works? Do the roads get ultimately sealed?
To the chair representative, there's in the administration section of the bill, there's key factors that go into place, and it's all based off of the site-specific plan and whether or not it's economically unreasonable for the project to move forward. If they can find clean gravel and use clean gravel, they have to do that. If it's economically unreasonable for them to find clean gravel, then they're allowed to move into using the gravel, but they have to bury it as subsurface. If they can't do that, then they can put it on top, but they have to seal it somehow. And so, and then if that's an economically unreasonable, the final say would be that they could leave it on top as top surface. But it's all dependent upon being whether or not it's economically unreasonable.
One final question on that last answer. So that last circumstance where they can leave it on top, does it have to be sealed or can it be loose like a gravel road?
To the chair representative.
You want to refer that to somebody else, or do you have an answer?
Actually, I would at this point would like to, if the committee would allow Roger Healy, who's with Department of Transportation. He's the resident expert.
We're encouraging people to know more than us to comment on this. Mr. Healy. And next we'll go to Representative Edgman after this question. Mr. Healy.
Good afternoon. Roger Healy, Chief Engineer with the Department of Transportation. And the question was in regards to covering naturally occurring asbestos material with material that is not naturally occurring asbestos. Is that ultimately the question?
Sure. I think in going through this sort of diagram of if it becomes more and more expensive, these are the lesser things we let you do. It sounded like at the end you would allow this naturally occurring asbestos to be the top layer, and I'm wondering if that's accurate. And if it is accurate, would that top layer have to be solid, or would that top layer be allowed to be loose?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the direction the regulations would take and are in what we understand this bill to say in coordination with Department of Health and Social Services is the top layer or that layer exposed to the public must not have naturally occurring asbestos material within it, or it shall not have a ability to become airborne. So in terms of alternatives in a construction project to encapsulate that material, if the economical source of material was naturally occurring asbestos material, you would look at that as your underlayers, say, but some form of cap would have to be put over that, whether or not that is potentially 12 inches of clean gravel material, a pavement layer, a chip seal. Depending upon what project it might be, some other alternative like that. But the point being is that for the foreseeable life of the project and that the material would not, the naturally occurring asbestos material would not be exposed to the public. Carry that on is that you must have an operation and maintenance plan as part of that to ensure that general use, whether or not it's annual operating maintenance of a gravel roadway, you maintain the surface according to what that MNO plan says.
Mr. Anderson, would you like that answer to replace your previous answer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Ishman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going back to Representative Jewell's comments about this bill being an adventure. I'm getting into it for the first time, and I can understand how the original intent of the bill might be pretty straightforward. But then you get into various layers, everything from liability to standards to multi-agencies working together to just a lot of things that really look like an omnibus bill, 13 pages here. So my question is, with you know, tomorrow we're going to be debating a bill with involved with the gas land somewhere in the future. But is this, how cutting edge is this whole subject? I know it's tied to Amber more specifically, but it seems like there's other cases in the Dalton Highway and there's one in Ock Bay and Juneau. But is this a bigger issue down the road for the state as a whole as we get into more extraction and more industrial projects? I'm trying to get a sense of scale here.
Mr. Healy, if you feel qualified.
To the chair, Representative Fetchman. As we all know, Alaska is a big state, and the mapping efforts that have gone are not as detailed as some other states, specifically California. That being said, we have noted, Dr. Anderson has noted that the naturally occurring asbestos typically is present in ultramafic rocks. Mineralized areas. We have many mineralized areas, one being southeast, basically stretching from Ketchikan north to ultimately the Haines District, the Ambler area as well, and also areas of the Dalton Highway. I would say yes, that this will become more of a developing issue, particularly as we seek other projects, such as the Roads and Resources projects that have already been mentioned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This issue has been around for a few years in Ambler, has it not? Representative Jill?
Through the chair. Representative Edgman. Yes.
And asbestos was there before you came along?
It's through the chair, Representative Edgman. This has been an ongoing issue in the community for a while.
Mr. Chairman, the project out here in the outskirts of Juneau and Ock Bay, is that operating without this sort of framework in place? Ostensibly it is, but would that project be impacted by a bill like this?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, it could potentially be affected. I think the site you're referring to is Stabler's Point Quarry, directly south and east of the ferry terminal. There has been naturally occurring asbestos found there. It's in small veins. Somewhat familiar with that area and that project is that is a contained mineral or material site where basically the city and borough are operating in accordance with workplace safety requirements, whether that be OSHA or the MSHA requirements, which are basically an airborne requirement. Whether the specific material out there, which is a rock and not a sand and gravel source, tests to the level of 0.25 or above, I'm not familiar with. So whether or not this bill here would directly impact that project, I can't say for sure right at the moment.
Okay, I think that's good for now. Thank you.
Representative Costello, thank you for your patience. Ms. Newman.
Oh, thank you.
You still remember your question?
I think so. It's an odd question, I think, but first I was wondering, is there any way or have you considered, Chair, making an exemption simply for the community that you're talking about rather than putting this in state statute?
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, Representative, we have tried and I'll also let Roger or Mr. Healy answer as well, but we tried, in a previous session we had a bill, HB 333, and at that point it was suggested that we could tackle this issue without statutory, without creating a bill and having a change in the statute. And that went forward for a couple of years unsuccessfully. And it's kind of come back around to where there are certain, it's my understanding that there are certain statutory requirements that DOT does need to move forward on this, that they do have to be provided some sort of a program and some boundaries and things like that.
Mr. Costello.
Through the chair, have you also considered a sunset date on the legislation?
Through the chair, Representative, that has not come up in any of the conversations, and I think I can ask the question and get back to you on that.
Through the chair. So what comes to mind for me is somebody who is flying either commercially or with a private pilot's license, and we have people all over the state of Alaska flying. My question has to do with exposure to people who would be flying into the airports, possibly passengers getting out. Have you considered, in the vein of Representative Guerra's notification question, working with the FAA so that their notices to airmen would include information about airports that might be located close to some, to an asbestos-related situation.
Mr. Healy.
Through the chair, Representative Costello. It's important to recognize that this bill will cover new projects. And I will have Representative Jewell refer to the existing conditions of the runway and material that may be present currently that has naturally occurring asbestos already. But in terms of what this bill would do is provide a mechanism whereby if naturally occurring asbestos material was used on a project, and say that was a DOT project, this would provide a mechanism for immunity to do that. But the final layer, that is what is available to, in contact with the public, cannot be naturally occurring asbestos per the analytical method that Dr. Anderson referred to. So there is naturally occurring asbestos in Ambler currently. But it's what this will do is any new project constructed, our plans will identify a method to encapsulate that, whether it's, again, through if the runway is to remain a gravel runway, then we will look at some cap of gravel to, whether that's 6 inches deep, 12 inches deep, whatever it may be, to ensure that that area would not become exposed to the public. I think the follow-on question from presented by Representative Guerra was, should signage or some form of notification be done just to notify the presence of that this material was used in some location? And I think Mr. Anderson covered that earlier.
Through the chair. So just to explain my concern, I think that under workplace safety, I understand you mean people who are knowingly working in this situation, and my concern is one step back so that the air carriers who are providing the materials that are oftentimes having to be flown into communities, that they too would come under some sort of protection so that they're aware of the situation also. That's where I'm coming from. Thank you.
Representative Newman, then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I'm looking at page 3, lines 23 and 24, it talks about this act accepts 0.25% by mass minimum detectable asbestos under the California Air Resources Board. The first thing that hit me is if I was to think of a state with the most restrictive environmental regulations, it would probably be California. It leads me to believe that when you looked at other states that had regulations on asbestos control or air control, that this was probably the gold standard, you know, as far as safety goes. I mean, I don't know what other states do this besides California. Did you look at that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we did. The two states that actually have viable working programs that are in effect are Virginia and California. We mimicked and we took a lot of examples from the California regulations and statute based off of their thoroughness of the program. Actually, a little bit of, if I could, a brief history, a little bit of the level of threshold, the analytical threshold. California actually started out at a 5% in 1996. They reduced it to 3%, and then in 2002, they reduced it down to 0.25, all based off of, you know, further studies and usage of the material. So, and 0.25 has been the level since 2002 in California, and that's why we chose that low level in regards to the percent, the 0.25%. It's working in California, so that's why. In regards to the CARB method, that method of testing, and Roger might be able to speak on it better as well, but that method was developed for California. There's various different methods of testing, but that one was the first step really to break away from most asbestos that we have is all construction asbestos that's been, through the process of milling, have been created what we know as asbestos, and that's, and this is actually naturally occurring asbestos, and California was the first one really to tackle a definition of naturally occurring asbestos as well.
A couple more questions, Chair. In regards to some questions by Representative Guerra, talked about signage and postage of signs and stuff, and the way I interpret it, again, on page 3 with section 1, directing the Department of Transportation, this would be for the gentleman from DOT, to come up with the standards and operating procedures to allow for how these are done. I'm assuming that was a standard procedure for DOT for signage and medical service data sheets, MSDS sheets, generally in the work shacks and operating shacks and things like that.
Through the chair, Representative Newman. Yes, nothing in this bill curtails or curtails any federal requirements, whether it be the OSHA or MSHA regulations or airborne standards for naturally occurring asbestos, nor would it obviate any proposed MSDS notices as well.
And then in regards to the monitoring, or how do you, the liability clause, you know, how do you prove that somebody who got lung cancer, and we've done a little bit of this with firemen, but how do you prove that somebody who got a specific lung cancer that's associated with, known to be associated with asbestos, how would you know that it came from that mine or that pit or that road? I mean, there's a lot of things in life where that could come from. I know when we were talking about this, I remember a job that I was on and told to go rip a furnace out that had 2 inches of asbestos all the way around it. You know, and I ripped it out and took it to the dump. And it's still in the dump somewhere, I would imagine. Where would you pick this stuff up, or how do you prove it specifically came? Do you know of any cases where they looked at that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I don't. Dr. Anderson might be able to answer that question better.
That's just trying to figure out how you prove cause, Mr. Chair. When it also talks on page 9, it says in that immunity, it says the party has direct control over responsibility. Who is the party? When we talk about that, is it the state? Is it the contractor? Is it the general contractor, subcontractors, the person that approves the permit? Who is the party?
through the chair, Representative Newman, in reference to the contractor that or the legal authority, that is the person that actually will be submitting the site-specific plan. So we have two scenarios here. We have construction projects that are created or done by the state as state projects. In that regards, the state would be the one that would be on the hook, so to speak, for the site-specific plan. And then in the guise of a third-party private, the contractor that actually would be doing the work as the legal authority of the project would be the one that would submit the site-specific plan and make sure the adherence to the plan is followed.
When we talked about control of this, you know, the bill specifically talks about how you're going to cap on roads and make sure it's not airborne and things like that. But as a guy who spent more than a few years bouncing around in an end dump, down pits and working on crushers and working in gravel pits, you know, when you're standing there on a crusher making little rocks out of big rocks, which you have to do to get the D1, you get the binding material, how do you protect those people from that dust? I mean, literally you're replacing those air filters every day, huge air filters. It's phenomenal, the amount of dust. I mean, how would you do that in a pit?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. What's important to recognize, again, is there are existing MSHA and OSHA regulations regarding airborne levels of asbestos. This is one of the things was learned at the Stabler's Point area in terms of there are, and I don't know them all specifically, but in regards to drillers and operators, there are requirements for whether it's dust mass or air particle mass that should be part of the daily regimen for that contractor working that site. There is a, for those sites which are thought to have naturally occurring asbestos, part of this effort in this bill would be to require testing, airborne testing, per the OSHA and MSHA requirements, much like is done in indoor asbestos abatement, where you have that you have a daily monitoring program that you have to submit samples for to make sure that your airborne asbestos levels for your workers are not above a hazardous level.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. And, you know, little question comes to my mind. We've got a lot of gold mines and other mines in the state that also do with gravel, and you mentioned MSHA, the mining safety hazard rules of federal operation safety hazard, OSHA. Would there be a fold over in there, because you get, you know, you might be, if you have a federal centerline highway project that's receiving federal funds and state gravel in here, is there going to be a fold in of more federal regulations on these projects, you think?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the federal, in regards to naturally occurring asbestos, the federal government, specifically EPA, has not provided what I would say either clarifications or specific rules other than what the existing laws that I referred to, whether it's MSHA or OSHA. And I will say that there is a representatives from DEC would be better answering this, but there is an airborne level for asbestos in terms of worker safety. What California law did and what is trying to emulate here is a testing level of soil with an assumption of what is safe for an airborne standard. So EPA has not come out with what is safe in soil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg and Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, certainly understand the problem and the direction we're trying to go to get through this. I mean, I've been up on Jade Mountain when I was a kid. I've been up at those gravel pits on the Dalton that are now shut down. You know, I've done a lot of dirt work, and some of this, you know, maybe there's a way, a path through this, but I guess we're going to have to find it. But the first question is, has there been any encapsulation studies done? I mean, I know that they're done on renovations for construction sites, but as far as dirt work, where you're treating the dirt, not encapsulating it in another level of fill or a lift and clean dirt, but are you talking about encapsulation with a chemical or some other product or something that would cover that? Is that what we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes. Again, depending upon the project, depending upon the type of project, its proposed longevity, the use of it, the materials that are available to cover any potential naturally occurring asbestos, whether that be, you know, the 12 inches of gravel I was referring to earlier, if it was, say, a very low-volume road and with a very low level of maintenance on it, would the 12 inches be, might be considered overkill? That would be a consideration. But basically the point is to not have the material that is analytically classified as naturally occurring asbestos be available for inhalation to the public. So whether that is, and that's what the plan approval process would work through, whether or not that is a chip seal, a pavement, a layer of clean material, open to other suggestions, but those are the ones that come to mind right off the bat.
If I may, Mr. Chair, a couple more. I've never been on a finished construction project where you didn't have to go back and cut out a new culvert, or you didn't have to put in new utilities for some reason where, by the definition of this project, would have been encapsulated and done. Now you're mixing materials. Now maybe by mixing materials you get below the 0.25 and that would not be a problem, or maybe the contractor is going to have to remove it completely. You know, just from, like, Representative Newman being the guy on the ground, you know, and it's blowing everywhere, I imagine the OSHA standards would protect the worker, but we're trying to protect the public here. You mentioned soil content. Soil isn't used in construction. So, I mean, we're looking about fill and dirt and rock and things like that. So, I'm just trying to make sure that, you know, I'm studying soil science now, so I'm just trying to make sure we're separating the two and they're not intermingling the terms. I mean, most people don't know that the manufacture of road material is manufactured. It's not taken from one place and put on another until it meets a certain standard. So when you're meaning soil, you're meaning fill.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. Yes.
Okay.
Also,
Mr. Anderson.
If I could direct the committee to page 10, starting at line 14, subsection G, there's a component there that requires, after the completion of the project, that the contractor submit some sort of document attached to the title of the property at the local recording property district, where it shows the work that's been done. Representative who sits on finance gave me the word, and I've forgot it already. Plat note to the recorded, so it can be referred to in the future. So if anybody does do construction work, that there's public notice that NOAA gravel has been used at the property, and that it would have some sort of marker of where it was used. And so there would be some sort of, before you go digging up, the landowner and the public would know that NOAA was used.
Another question, Mr. Chair, if I may. The success of every construction project, dirt project, is either that one or the previous one before it is stockpiling material. You bring in a crusher plant, you operate a grizzly, you do all those things, and there's efficiencies into building a lot of stockpile of manufacturing material, D1, and all those other things that you need. But I've never been on a construction site that was available to the public where the public didn't come and borrow some of it. I mean, it's, you know, it's even in my backyard, they stockpile gravel or a pea gravel, and it always disappears. So I imagine that would continue under this, but outside of signage, how would you protect the public or restrict access to it? Is that part of your plan, perceived as being part of the plan of operation, or would it be wrapped in something?
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, the actual specifics of the scenario you're thinking of, we haven't worked out. Yeah, I would think it would be appropriate for regulations to task the contractor with some form of site security notification. Also, in terms of the construction process and timelines and everything else, there are established best management practices, whatever you want to call it, that California has adopted on many of their projects, specifically in terms of, you know, when you're if you are laying down a layer of naturally occurring asbestos material, you have to water to basically have no visible signs of dust. Speed limits are enforced on the project, where typically it's no more than 15 miles an hour. There's a number of measures that are basically recommended to keep the dust level down for the birds.
Thank you. There was only one person signed up that wasn't with a government agency, and I've been remiss in not noticing that Elizabeth Hensley from Casaview was online, and I hope you're still there, Ms. Hensley.
Yes, hello.
Yes, we haven't. Yes, I did forget about you. I was going to say we hadn't forgotten about you, but that would be a lie. But, we did. I did notice you, and please introduce yourself and your comments on the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elizabeth Savulik Hensley. I am the Corporate and Public Policy Liaison at NANA Regional Corporation. We are headquartered in Casaview. I'm based in Anchorage. And I just would really like to say thank you to Representative Jewell for sponsoring this bill again, and to his staff, Roy Anderson, for working so diligently to get this through, because, and as has already been said, there are a lot of projects that are on hold in the village of Ambler, also in Hobuck, and the community is really kind of at their wit's end, and they would like to see progress. So I, on behalf of NANA, thank you. I would also like to say that the Northwest Arctic Leadership Team, which is, as many of you are familiar, NANA, Manilik Association, the Northwest Arctic Borough, and the Northwest Arctic Borough School District, they've all come together and said that this is their priority as well, so they would like to see it move. And I also have here with me Lance Miller, our Vice President of Resources, and if it's all right,
While you're here, why don't we hear from him, and you can acquaint him with the process if he's unaware.
Thank you. Here you go.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Lance Miller, and again, I'm Vice President of Natural Resources.
Can you speak a little louder or into your microphone, or if you're on the telephone, you're barely audible, sir.
Anyway, I was on the other side of the room. Hello, this is Lance Miller. I am Vice President of Natural Resources for NANA Regional Corporation. And again, yes, thank you for the efforts on this, and we do support this work. I guess just another perspective on it, that listening to the conversation, it might be important for those of you who have not been to the region to realize, of course, that The gravel bars right below Ambler are from eroded rock from Jade Mountain, other places with these ultramafic rocks that Roger Healy mentioned. And actually some of the highest levels of asbestos are actually in naturally occurring gravel bars along the river. So, you know, we really appreciate the efforts of trying to move this forward in a way that we can use this material in basically, you know, a sound way to address some of the legal issues. But just wanted to let people know that, again, the folks in the region have obviously been living with this for thousands of years. And this was spoken to earlier, and Representative Jewell mentioned it, how people in Ambler were very aware of it. So I just want to make it clear how, you know, how widespread it is in that specific area, and people are aware of it. And be happy to answer any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I live right on Kinnick Arm, and I know my house, when the wind's blowing from Palmer, as it does every once in a while, we get that fine gravel clay, and it comes with such force, it embeds itself into the window seals, and it makes it all the way through the screen soffits and inside, which kind of surprised me how much force there is and how that carries. When you mentioned that you have naturally occurring asbestos at high levels that's eroded, and I don't know what the – I've been to Kotzebue a few times, but I just don't remember how windy it was. I remember it was cold when I've been there. But is that the type of and Ambler's, I don't know how many air miles away it is. But I didn't ever get to go there. I think we might have flown over it. Is there a parallel circumstance? Is this stuff blowing already? If you followed our health concerns on the screen, maybe it's not healthy for those people to live there at all?
Not if I can answer that through the chair. Some parallels maybe, but you know, certainly the Matanuska Valley, I mean, we've all seen in the winter, especially the dust that blows, and maybe you don't want to have that material tested for asbestos, but it might be interesting.
It's better to not know, right?
but it's a little bit different because you don't have as much exposed glacial dust and erosion from the moraines and things and the river, the big rivers that you do, you know, in the Matsu Valley there. In Ambler, one, it's not quite the same winds, but further to that, you know, frankly, much of the area is covered. It's either frozen and or covered with snow for, 8 months of the year sometimes. So that's, I think, another aspect of this is there is sort of a natural self-sealing to this stuff. For much of the year. So I wouldn't say there's similar type of airborne events like you'd experience down in South Central Alaska. No.
Any other questions for either Ms. Hensley or Mr. Miller? Well, thank you both for waiting. I'm sorry I forgot about you in the process. While we're here, is there anybody else from the general public who maybe hasn't signed up but is listening, wanted to testify? Either here in Juneau or online. We'll go ahead and close the public process only as a formality. We are very deferential to people who express a will to testify at a later point if there's a. But we'll continue on with our questioning. Representative Dugan.
I think it's Representative Fairclough.
Oh, Fairclough.
Go ahead.
No, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a group of questions that are outside of the health concern issues.
Before we get started here, I'm going to announce I'd rather spend the rest of the time. We will bring up 3:37 as we'll slip it in for the sponsor the earliest possible next opening. So my staff will talk to the sponsor and the department people. So. Probably kept you guys here too long as it was, so we're going to finish up with this bill today. Sorry, I wanted
to the sponsor, Representative Jewell, you said that privately owned land, is that where the extraction would occur at, was from privately held property, or were you referring to the privately held land when you were talking about the cost of projects for where the materials that have naturally occurring asbestos would be placed?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, as is the case in most villages that are part of the Land Claim Settlement Act, the land around the communities, if in the case of communities where they have their own corporate, well, it doesn't make any difference. You either have a subsurface and a surface issue, and in this case, this is privately owned land or native allotments in the area. Being not a regional corporation, privately.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to determine is, I'll try it a different way. We're in the proposed bill, we have language that says DOT will record and map out where projects where the use of naturally occurring asbestos in the aggregate materials, where those projects are placed inside of a community, and that we'll keep a recording of those particular projects. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative, that's correct.
So, Mr. Anderson, you know that one of my concerns was what happens when we identify on different parcels of property throughout the state, because this is not exclusive to the one region. It's being proposed to be across the state of Alaska. So we go through, and this is an issue of competition for me as well as public safety. So we identify gravel pits now that have naturally occurring asbestos, but we're not keeping track of it. At least it's not proposed in this legislation that we keep track of it. And if we have that information internally to DOT, then people or contractors who have some kind of a relationship with a previous project that they know where to go to find more economical gravel will have a different ability to bid jobs if they know where those extraction points are at, because we're not making that public information. And that cuts both ways. It could be a private owner that's wanting to sell it. So I'm just wondering about mapping in the public health hazard of pits that are located along corridors that, at least in this legislation, we haven't proposed to map.
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, I was to, as a follow-up after our conversation on Friday, the first thing I did today actually was start that to ask those questions, and I was able to briefly talk with Mr. Haley here, and then also I've presented it to Department of Law as well. But I think he might be able to touch briefly on it. I don't know if it's going to answer your question fully, though.
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough. The issue of, first of all, in terms of the material sites, there would have to be some determination made. Is this site actually have naturally occurring asbestos or not? And that would be the whole testing regimen that, if it is a private site, is department's position would be that would be incumbent upon the owner to identify whether or not you have naturally occurring asbestos or not to fall under this bill that ultimately is providing immunity for that material.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up. There's a health risk that's still out there for a pit that has been mined, and we're not requiring under this bill a plat note that says we're going to, on a project, provide immunity if the aggregate with naturally occurring asbestos is included in a project. We'll require that mapping so that future landlords understand that they're picking up a liability. It says that right in here. If you buy one of these pieces of property, a project, that you have some liability and responsibility to make sure that future remediation, like if we're coming in and doing a road repair under a government project, that we have to know that we've got a road that's been laid down with naturally occurring asbestos. If you're taking down a building or if they've used a foundation, we're requiring on that plat note under this proposal that the new building owner or the current building owner know that asbestos, naturally occurring asbestos, is used as part of that foundation. So what happens, and this is what I asked Mr. Anderson, so if I'm Nana Regional Corporation or if I'm some other landowner, including the state of Alaska, and I have a pit and I've identified it, what responsibility do I have to notify the general public? I mean, you're saying that they would, but how are you going to map it, and if it makes it cheaper for some projects, then how do we let other contractors in the area know? Otherwise, we're creating an unfair bidding advantage for someone who does know where a pit's at that doesn't have it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fairclough. I'll try and answer your question. You may need to remind me again. For the material site owner, private entity, who has tested their material and identified that there is predominantly, say, naturally occurring asbestos material within there. That's sort of the basis upon which we're working on, and what notification a contractor may have, or what the owner must provide as a notification to either the contractor or to somebody, just an ordinary citizen using that material. Is that the ultimate, one of the concerns you have?
One of the concerns is if there's a plat note on that piece of property so that owner knows that he has a responsibility to either cover and protect that site. If you're small children in a community, and it's not in Ambler but in Anchorage, Alaska, and you have kids running through thinking it's the latest ball field or soccer field that they're playing on, there's that kind of a responsibility, and then there's the contractor responsibility. If someone's in there mining it and has access to that pit, is it an open access then that anybody can pipe gravel from it, and do they notify the contractors as they go, and are we then recording where those contractors are hauling that aggregate to?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Fairclough. This bill will cover existing projects. So under an existing material site that is just open, it is a privately owned site currently and is potentially not gated, restricted to public access other than potentially no trespassing sign. This bill will not cover that. It won't provide any further restrictions or requirements upon the landowner to keep the people at bay or to remediate that site other than what they may already be required to do so under, I believe it's Statute 27, the mining reclamation requirements under DNR currently. If it's a new site, then the issue of whether or not there is notification to the users, I think, is one issue of that material. And I would say that would ultimately be covered in regulation. The follow-on question was material under a new project, if we are building a new project, whether it was the school playground you were referring to or a ball field or whatever it may be, the point of seeking immunity under this bill would be that the owner or the contractor would have to submit plan approval for that. That plan approval is incumbent upon them covering the material with non-NOA material, or not having that exposed to the public.
Mr. Chairman, if I might
question.
Continue. I'm certainly willing to yield. Mr. Keeley, I've read the bill, so I know what.
I can't yield. We're going to end up adjourning pretty soon. Please go ahead.
What is in the bill? And my point was, it's not in the bill as far as if it's an outside landowner, we're not mapping that. So there could be corridors or pits that are established that we might not know about. I'm looking at a T version bill, so I think it's on page 8 maybe of the next bill. But I've asked for a description of what someone thinks is reasonably uneconomical, and that's a whole other issue where the department is saying, trust me, at least in determining that. And so I understand the economics issue. I've lived in Dutch Harbor. I took a boat back and forth to high school, so I know that there are challenges in different communities than in urban areas, and things are more costly. But I don't know how you sidebar reasonably uneconomical. It's not even uneconomical; it's reasonably, and that makes it very subjective.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I would say that the determination of reasonably uneconomical, I'm sorry if I've reversed the two words there.
I know what you reversed.
Yeah, the type of project is part of the equation. The size of project is also part of the equation. What the final use of the project is also part of the consideration in whether or not this particular application of NOA material or not is reasonably uneconomic or not. I would say and I believe that what this bill provides is that determination or the ground rules for that to be laid out within regulation and presented in regulation.
Okay. We will stop right here today. I meant to stop at 3:30, but we will pick up over the phone. We had a few people waiting for questions. But, we will set this bill aside and try to figure out. I could read around the table. There are some concerns. We'll see where we can get to there. I know there are a couple of people that had questions, but we've had a pretty good dialogue today. I know where we left off and know who had the questions, so we will come back to this issue. We'll let you know before the meeting, next meeting starts. We'll bring this back forward.
Are we going to have the department soon, Mr. Chair, at that next meeting?
Well, I think if they're interested in this bill, they'll be back. And also, we had our legal staff from Legislative Legal here. I know at one point there was a desire to have her up in part of the questioning. Maybe that might be useful if she does come back. I hate to pull people away from the other building where they're working on other projects, but maybe next meeting we can make a little better use of the legal talent and ability we have in the room rather than trying to muddle through these things ourselves. So with that, we are adjourned today's meeting. We'll come back tomorrow. We have a couple of we have bills, House Bill 196, bulk fuel loans, House Bill 261, commercial fishery entry permit loans. That's both from Representative Edgman. I should have told him that I decided to cancel it because he wasn't here for it. And then House Bill 9, we're going to have that back before us. I think you guys might have as good a plan or an idea what's going to happen with that as I do. But there's been a lot of questions, and we'll go through as deliberative a process as we can, including public testimony on that. There'll be other hearings that not scheduled, but I want to let the public know when they're going to have an opportunity. That will be a public testimony opportunity first round.
Mr. Chairman, 8:30?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock, okay, thank you.
We're adjourned.